Welcome back to What's at Risk. I'm Mike Christian.
Well, sometimes I don't know where this dirty road is taking me. Sometimes I can't even see the reason why. I guess I'll keep a gambling, lots of booze and lots of rambling. Oh, it's easier than just waiting around to die.
From a New York Times review of the autobiography of an execution, statistics from the Death Penalty Information Center show that the death penalty in America is dying. In 2009, the number of death sentences dropped for the seventh consecutive year. It is now the lowest since the Supreme Court reinstated the death penalty in 1976. 11 states considered abolishing the death penalty last year, citing high cost and lack of measurable benefits. New Mexico just became the 15th state to abolish it. A recent study from Duke University concluded that North Carolina could save almost $11 million annually by doing away with capital punishment.
When you're here in Uncle Sam's chair.
Beyond the high costs, lengthy appeals processes, and racial biases that affect the capital system, lies a growing public uneasiness that we are sometimes executing the wrong people. According to the Innocence Project, 17 people on death row have now been exonerated by DNA evidence.
When I was just a baby, my mama told me, son, always be a good boy, don't ever play with guns. But I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. When I hear that whistle blowing, I hang my head and cry.
Still, David Dow is in Texas, drowning in the death penalty. As he explains, I understand the death penalty supporters. I used to be one. I can relate to the retributive impulse. I know people I want to kill. But he devotes his life to fighting for his clients, many of whom he dislikes enormously, and all but seven of whom he believes to be guilty, because he's certain that what Justice Harry Blackmun called the American machinery of death is broken. Cops fudge the truth. They coerce false testimony. Court-appointed lawyers sleep through trials. They miss deadlines. They fail to put on exculpatory evidence. Juries believe every word uttered by so-called expert witnesses who opine on defendants they have never met. Jurors evade responsibility by hiding behind the other jurors. Judges evade responsibility by hiding behind jury verdicts, and appeals courts hide behind the trial courts. The Supreme Court can hide from a case by refusing to take it. Elected judges, particularly in Texas, must deliver convictions. Federal judges named to the federal bench because they are pals with a senator overlook deeply flawed trials.
And should have gone again, execution day.
Hangman! Hangman! Hold it a little while. I think I see my
And by the time Dow comes into a case, the law will sometimes not permit him to help his client. As he explains, prosecutors and judges kowtow to family members of murder victims who demand an eye for an eye, and the lonely lawyer declaiming about proper procedures is a shouting lunatic in the asylum.
Time in Texas, I'm going where the blue
As an appellate lawyer, Dow has represented more than 100 death row inmates over the past 20 years. Many of his clients have died. Most were guilty. Some might have been innocent. The autobiography of an execution is a gripping chronicle of a life lived at paradoxical extremes, witnessing executions and then coming home to the loving embrace of his wife and young son, who inquire how his day went. David Dow is the University Distinguished Professor at the University of Houston Law Center and the Litigation Director at Texas Defender Service, a nonprofit legal aid corporation that represents death row inmates. His work has appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Christian Science Monitor, and many other publications.
We're speaking with David Dow, the author of The Autobiography of an Execution. So, David, I'm just going to guess that you didn't set out to do what you're doing now with these death row inmates. How did you get into the business of defending these guys?
That's an accurate guess. I didn't set out to do this. I got into the business entirely by accident. I teach at the University of Houston Law Center, and I was teaching there 20 years ago when I got into this, and I had an academic interest in the death penalty. I didn't have an ideological or philosophical interest in it. And as a result of that academic interest, I went to death row one day and met a bunch of death row inmates, and it so happened that one of the guys who I met was scheduled to be executed 2 weeks from the day that I met him. And his lawyer had just quit working on his case. Back in those days, death row inmates did not have a right to have lawyers helping them in their appeals. And at that time, I would describe myself as somewhere between a death penalty agnostic and a moderate death penalty supporter. I certainly wasn't against the death penalty. But I did think that if we were going to be executing someone, the person should be represented by a lawyer. And so I agreed to work on that case. And then one case turned into two, and two turned into three, and then all of a sudden 20 years go by, and it's what I've been doing with my life.
You've dealt with well over 100 of these death row inmates, right?
I have dealt with well over 100, most of them in Texas, not all in Texas. I've had a handful in other states around the country, but most of them have been right here in Texas.
Do you see a commonality of background amongst these guys?
I do. There are obviously exceptions. There are two, three, four people on death row who grew up in what you might call a middle-class type of environment, but that's very rare. For almost all of the people on death row, I could tell you what their biography was without even spending very much time with them. Most of them are from terribly abusive home environments. They have moms or dads or both who abuse them in all sorts of ways, psychological, physical, sexual. They almost always are from families with very limited resources, sometimes no resources in the sense of economic resources. They're from deeply shattered families, and so they end up drifting towards gangs because it's, in my judgment, a substitute for the type of support that people like me get from their mom and dad and siblings. They're largely uneducated. A lot of times that's obviously their own doing. They quit school, but they're largely uneducated. A very significant number have mental health issues. Some are mentally retarded. Some have other types of mental health issues, often that haven't been identified and typically that haven't been treated. I think those are pretty common characteristics. Most of them are people, in my opinion, who, if they had had some intervention in their lives earlier, whether it was from the state criminal justice system or the child protective services or what have you, they could have been put on a path that would have led them to a very different place from death row, but they weren't, and I think that's why they end up being my clients.
Is it hard for you to try and save people that you probably, in many cases, don't like and may be certain that they are guilty? Is that a difficult thing?
It is a difficult thing. I talk in the book about the fact that I've been married for 16 years, and my wife and I have a 9-year-old boy. And a lot of the people who I meet and represent are people who killed children, sometimes their own children. A lot of the people I meet are people who killed their own girlfriends, their own spouses. And I think that it's natural for me to be looking at these people who have done horrible things and at the same time to be holding in the back of my mind images of the people who I love, my wife, my son, my parents, my brothers, sisters, friends. So Yeah, it can be very difficult to be a lawyer, to be a zealous lawyer, an aggressive advocate on behalf of someone who, in most cases, has committed an absolutely horrible act. Now, as I say in the book, of the 100 or so people I've represented, there are 6 or 7, maybe 8, who I believe didn't commit the crime. But what that means is that 95% of them did commit the crime, and the crimes are horrible crimes. And in many of these cases, it's possible for me intellectually to understand how my clients ended up where they are, to understand the cause and effect of growing up driftless, aimless, in this abusive type of environment, and to understand how that can turn a person into somebody who doesn't behave appropriately and who does horrible criminal acts. But understanding something intellectually doesn't mean that you don't have emotional reactions to it. And I suspect that the emotional reactions that I have in many of these cases are really not very different at all from the emotional reactions that people who are strong death penalty supporters have.
Well, along those lines, you know, most of us have never seen an execution, obviously. Is the process somewhat clinical, or can you at the end really, is the emotion and the finality of it really palpable?
I would say that the last 24 hours leading up to an execution, and including the execution itself, it's a period that neatly divides into two categories. And in one group of the cases, the person who's getting executed has really prepared for that execution. The lawyers have explained that the person is going to be executed on schedule, that there aren't going to be any last-minute stays, and the person has had the opportunity to write his final letters, say goodbye to his mom, dad, brothers, sisters, etc. And in those cases, it is, as you describe, it's somewhat clinical. The way we execute people everywhere in the United States today is by lethal injection. You have an inmate strapped to a gurney and injected with a bunch of poison, and part of the lethal injection protocol includes the introduction of a paralytic agent. And what that does is paralyze the inmate, and the reason for the paralysis is not to contribute to the death of the inmate, but it's rather to prevent the inmate from moving. So it's for the sake of the witnesses, really. It looks peaceful. The person has been paralyzed, and so when there's a drug that's introduced that induces cardiac arrest, the person doesn't flop all over the table and strain against the straps because the person's been paralyzed. So it really is very clinical. It doesn't look violent. That's one category of cases. The other category of cases, at the end, they look the same because you have somebody strapped to a gurney, even if he's not prepared to die, and he dies the same way as someone who is prepared to die. But the other category of cases are difficult in a different kind of way for the inmate and also for the inmate's lawyers, and those are the cases where the person really believes up until close to the very end that the lawyers are going to succeed in getting a last-minute stay. And sometimes the person believes that because the lawyers have misled him. Sometimes the person believes that because the lawyers really did believe it themselves. And sometimes the person believes it just because human beings have this will to live, and that sometimes translates into this completely irrational hope that they're going to get a stay of execution. And when it comes time to tell those inmates that it really is the end of the road and that they're going to have to walk those last 8 steps from the holding cell to the gurney and that they're going to get strapped down and have IVs inserted and executed, and that's going to happen in 20 minutes, those can be very volatile and unpleasant conversations to have. And I've had to have those a few times, and they're not easy and they're not pleasant, and I don't expect that they would become easy or pleasant even if I had to have them 1,000 times.
Warden, led the prisoner down the hallway to his doom. I stood up to say goodbye like all the before they reach my cell.
We're here with David Dow, author of Autobiography of an Execution.
Speaking of getting a stay, tell us a little bit about the legal process or the legal system as it relates to the final process of an execution.
A death penalty trial is really two trials, and at the first trial, the jury decides that the bad guy did what the state said he did, and then at the second trial, the jury decides whether the person should be on death row or sentenced to life in prison. And once you get past that stage, there are three layers of appeals that are left, but each layer becomes increasingly more challenging. That is, at the first layer, you have a small chance to get a new trial or to have the person moved off of death row, but it's small. And on that second layer, it's even smaller. And at the third layer, it's almost invisible. So that by the time you get to that last layer of appeals, you really know that you're pursuing futility. There might be very strong legal issues, so that I, as a lawyer, might really think that I've got a great legal issue and my client should get a new trial or should get his death sentence transformed into a life sentence. But for a variety of technical legal reasons, it would probably put people to sleep. Even if you have a really compelling legal claim, it's hard for the courts to grant relief, even in those cases. And so what that means is that the final scenes in this drama are scenes where we really know the ending. The lawyers know the ending. The inmates know the ending. Everybody really knows the ending. There are obviously some exceptional cases. In two or three or four or five cases out of 100, it might be that the lawyers catch lightning in a bottle and the person doesn't get executed on schedule. But in the other 80 or 90 or 95% of the cases, the person does. And so that's really what is going on during the finer layers of the appeal. The final layer of the appeal might last a year. So the person is living the last year really knowing that it's borrowed time. And that is precisely part of the real frustration of being a death penalty lawyer, I think. And one of the things I try to do in the book is really to try to dig deep into that frustration and show not only how it affects the lawyers, but how it has an effect on the whole rest of the life of the lawyers. Because for a year, you'll be working very hard on a case, and you come to believe that your client's rights were violated and that your client is entitled to be moved off of death row into the general prison population. And that belief really burrows into you, and then you get to the last week or month before the execution, and the belief is shattered. And that can be a hard thing to have to deal with time after time after time after time after time.
And I assume the judges aren't necessarily always accommodating to the process.
The judges aren't, and I think that the reason is that the state court judges they're politicians. They're elected by the people of Texas, and the people of Texas, like the people everywhere else, support the death penalty. And so if you're hoping to be a judge, you better support the death penalty too, or your hope of being a judge is going to be thwarted. Federal judges don't have to run for office, and they're appointed for life, but they're appointed by presidents, and I think that presidents are not all that much different from state court judges in the sense that they need to support the death penalty if they expect to be elected. If they oppose the death penalty, they certainly better not announce that. And if they do support the death penalty, it means that they're going to tend to nominate federal judges who support the death penalty as well. And so I think we have both judges in the state courts who support the death penalty because the population does, and we have judges on the federal bench who support the death penalty because the person who appointed them does, or at least says he does.
If executions were public, do you think we'd all still support the death penalty?
You know, I think that if executions were public, it wouldn't really make that much difference. And the reason is because of the way we carry out these executions that we were talking about just a moment ago. I think that if executions were on television, people would pick up the remote and flip to some other station. They would be so boring. I think that if we executed people using some other method, if we had a firing squad or an electric chair or hanging, I think it would be more gruesome and people might watch for the same reason that people watch car crashes or something like that. I think that if there were to be any part of the death penalty machinery that could change people's minds about the death penalty by becoming public, it would be access to the people on death row. That is, if people in the public really had some access to death row inmates and could see that, contrary to this popular mythology, the people who were on death row were not really the worst of the worst. They're just people who did a really, really, really bad thing. But when you go to death row, it's not like seeing a whole bunch of Hannibal Lecters. What you see are people who did something that is absolutely terrible, sometimes unforgivable, but you see them as people. You see them talking to their moms and their dads, and very frequently to their sons and their daughters. And I think that if people could see the inmates on death row as human beings rather than as caricatures, I think that that would have much more of an impact on popular support for the death penalty than, say, witnessing executions would.
Death zone, have no mercy in this land. You know, death zone, have no mercy in this land. In this land.
We're here with David Dow, author of Autobiography of an Execution.
Your book is very emotional and personal. This whole job that you have must take a toll on you and obviously your family. Do you ever think about stopping?
I do think about stopping. I think about stopping pretty much every single day. And I just can't bring myself to stop. I don't know for sure why that is. I think it's goes all the way back to the reason I got into this in the first place, which is that I think that if we as a society are going to be executing people, we need to be making sure that those people have lawyers who are going to stick with them up until the very end. But as you point out, it's impossible not to take the work home with me. And the reason that I wrote the book is because I realized I was taking the work home with me. When my son pointed it out, he said, "Dada, whenever you walk in the house when you come home from work, you seem glum." He was, I think, 3 years old when he told me I seemed glum. And so I decided I would try to leave the glumness behind by writing it down on the page so that when I walk into my house after getting home from the prison, I could leave the glumness on the page that I would leave in my car rather than carrying it into the kitchen with me. And that's really how the book came about. One of the things that I really try to do in the book is to try to explain how people who do the kind of work that I do make the different, very different parts of their life fit together in a coherent whole.
Hopefully it was cathartic for you. Last question, do you still believe in capital punishment as an effective deterrent after all your experiences?
No, I don't. I will tell you that I had a client get executed a couple of years ago who, when he was in middle school, had a tour of death row. The problem with idea of thinking that the death penalty makes us safer is that we're killing people who don't approach the questions in life the same way that rational economists do. They kill often where they didn't even intend to kill. It's a drug deal that's gone bad. It's a convenience store robbery that's gone bad. And I've come to the conclusion that we don't make society any safer when we execute criminals. We can make society just as safe by keeping them in prison for the rest of their lives. And if we were to do that, if we were to keep bad people in prison instead of killing them, I think we would keep society safe in a way that I myself think is a more morally acceptable way to keep society safe than carrying out executions.
Well, the name of the book is The Autobiography of an Execution, written by David Dow. It's a fascinating take on a really tough subject. David, is there a place where the listeners can get more information?
I think they can get more information by reading about the book at the website of 12, which is the publisher, or you can probably go to Amazon.com and read what other people who have already read the book have to say about it.
There ain't no grave can hold my body down. There ain't no grave can hold my body down. When I hear that trumpet sound, I'm gonna rise right out of the ground. Ain't no grave can hold my body down.
That's it for this week's edition of What's at Risk. I'd like to thank our guests tonight, Brad Bailey, partner with Denner Pellegrino, and attorney David Dow, author of Autobiography of an Execution. I'd like to thank our producer, Johnny Pfister of Ringo Studio, and our associate producer, Scott Cooper. We're interested in what you're thinking about. Send us an email at what's at risk@ at risk-strategies.com and let us know what's on your mind.
For podcasts of What's at Risk, go to wbz.com/risk.
Are you ready? Are you not for the risky run? The risky run.
You've been listening to What's at Risk, heard every Saturday night on WBZ News Radio 1030 and streaming on WBZ.com.
Run the risk.
When your company is considering risk management and consultative support for your business insurance, make the right choice and call Risk Strategies Company. With offices in Massachusetts, New York, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and Irvine, California, Chicago, and Providence, Risk Strategies Company takes a team approach to protecting your assets efficiently and cost-effectively. By offering a wide range of services and capabilities, Risk Strategies Company brings the highest level of expertise to clients in all areas of insurance and risk management, delivering insurance solutions, extensive carrier relationships and marketing expertise, claim advocacy, loss control safety management, health and welfare coverage, life and executive compensation plans, personal insurance lines, and surety. For the most comprehensive risk management and insurance coverage for your business, depend on Risk Strategies Company. Learn more at risk-strategies.com or call 617-330-5700. 617-330-5700.